time to forge the narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative, where we are going to be your source for 8th edition. We're not going to be your source. Warhammer Community is going to be your source for 8th edition 40k stuff. Can you believe the amount of stuff they're putting out?
It's unbelievable, guys.
I'm swimming in it, and it's the most buoyantly joyous thing ever.
Tonight I got Adam Abramowitz.
Hey everybody.
And Chris Morgan.
I'm just high on Aether Gold.
Well, we're going to talk about Caradhron Overlords here in a minute, too. There's a ton to cover. We're going to have a normal show today. I know we had the quick show, our reaction to the 8th edition news we got. It feels like forever ago, but it was just a few days.
Well, for those of us who are still on like the 3rd edition schedule, like our bodies are kind of adapting to the news flow. You know what I'm talking about, Paul, where it's like every 6 months something happens. It's kind of like jet lag for edition lag.
That's
so every time we get like a new update every day, it's like, oh man, 6 months ago they told us this. No, that was just yesterday.
This is episode 189. We are the Battle of Lost Souls podcast. You guys may have heard me on the independent characters this week. Carl's always great to talk to.
Carl's a great guy.
Yeah, it was very funny listening to him smack talk my Whirlwind Scorpius.
He says he's ready, man. He says he's ready for a rematch.
Oh, me too. Anytime, Carl.
Check out their show. I'm sure you do already, but please check out their show if you haven't. You can find them in iTunes at theindependentcharacters.com. I was going to make a very clever list of like the top 5 ways to stay productive while you're daydreaming about 40K 8th edition. And I only came up with one thing. You want to know what that is?
Paint something.
quit your job because it's going to be impossible.
Okay. I can get behind that.
I have been painting. I'm painting for Age of Sigmar, actually. You guys know, if you follow me on Twitter, you see my progress for the Sylvaneth. I'm currently working on some Kurnoth Hunters, and I just did a Kitbash. I know I'm plugging lots of stuff, but the Kitbash crew is actually a community of almost 700 folks at this point on Facebook. It's a Facebook group called the Kitbash Crew, KITBASH. CREW, 2 words, and I just posted up a kitbash of what I'm using as a branch witch based off of the Slaughter Priest from the White Dwarf relaunch that everyone got.
It actually looks pretty cool.
Chris, thank you for sending me that.
Yeah, man. I mean, he was just sitting in my box of random plastic model bits. It's where I keep all of the Adepticon swag. You know, any miscellaneous kit goes in that box, and when you said you were looking for one, I was like, I think I have one.
Oh, yeah, I really appreciate that. It's one of those things to where it's bigger than you might expect. That's a big model. It's a big dude when you put him together. He stands, a head and a half taller than a Marine, I think, but he's still shorter than the Hunter. So he's going to be bigger than a Dryad and smaller than a Hunter, and I think be imposing on the tabletop. And so I'm looking forward to painting that. I haven't put any paint on that yet, but I've almost got a 2,000 point force complete.
That's
got
to feel good.
Your Kurnoth Hunters, are they the ones with the bows?
I got 6 with bows and then 6 with size. And you can also equip them with swords, but I think size and bows are the best.
I think the size are a good way to run it. And most of the lists I've been seeing are 3 with bows, 3 with size. Paul, your Revenants, in my opinion, are some of your best work. I'm really impressed with them. They look really awesome.
Blending that Nihilus Oxide, I mean, that did a lot of the work. You know, of course, it's one of those miracle products. And then the orange of the weapons that I carried over from using the Hunters. And it just kind of worked. I don't know. We'll see how it all looks when it's together, but I'm happy with how it's going so far. Well, we mentioned a bunch of stuff getting dropped for 40K, but there's also been things, continuation of the products that we've already got in our hands right now, Shadow Wars Armageddon. These are some of the things that actually kind of like get you by. Maybe you don't want to invest a bunch of time in building a new 7th edition 40K army, but Shadow Wars Armageddon is a pretty quick get up and go. The rules, you probably know somebody with the rules already, and it's squad-based combat, and some of these armies are simply a handful of 4 or 5 figures. I think, you know, we talked about Harlequins, but even Orcs. An Orc army for this, or I guess an Orc force for this game is only, you know, maybe 9-10 figures, not even a box of boys.
And one of the things that I've had is like a mental hurdle to get my head around the idea that, oh, you know, the armies that you expect to have tons of dudes don't. is just how hard it is to really kill something for good.
Well, I think that's, of course, kind of the intent, right? Is to, so you can have these persistent figures that you can make into like little personalities, or, you know, have some type of role within your gang and or your force. I don't know. I forget what they're called now. I'm still on Necromunda terms, but you get the idea that these are supposed to be kind of personalities that carry through each game.
And I like that. That was, you know, that's always been kind of the curse of 40K and Kill Team, is just like, here's my specialist. His name is Bill. Bill, the awesome specialist guy. He's got a sniper rifle. And Bill is dead.
Well, Bill can now live on in this. But recently, I think in the last couple of days, depending on when you're hearing this, they released multiplayer, I guess more than two players, rules for Shadow War Armageddon on the Warhammer community site. And it's not a whole new rule set. What it is a couple of missions, but the big difference is how multiple combats work. I think that's one of the biggest things here, is that in multiple combats involving three or more players, the players whose turn it is currently decides which order the fighters will fight. However, they cannot choose for two enemy fighters to fight each other, and this will often mean that their fighter must fight two opponents in succession.
Yeah, and the guy who goes last, you know, the guy who fights the owning player last, he gets combat bonuses, presumably because he's just been like sitting back watching, you know, everybody take turns like rock 'em sock 'em robots in the face. Then the winner, he steps up, he's like, all right, here's my extra attack and my combat score because you're already worn down.
I think it's really great of them to continue to support this stuff. And we haven't talked about Blood Bowl in a while, too, but Forge World is still producing. They're producing some amazing Blood Bowl figures to support that game. And we're really living where you can get different types of experiences, or valuable, meaningful experiences, game niches filled, all within the same company.
Yeah, didn't a Bretonian team just come out?
Are they Bretonian or just another flavor of humans in general, like an Empire team?
They feel very Bretonian. And that they're all shiny and not spiky
the name
at
is
all.
Like the shiny Shinersons or something, I think is what it is.
Yeah, the shiny Shinersons. So something paladins of whatever. But I was reading their description and I thought, well, GW, you're sending me some mixed messages here, because basically what you're saying is these guys follow the rules, but they also don't win games.
Well, you know, sometimes you can't follow the rules in Blood Bowl. You just got to bring out a chainsaw and go to work.
No, see, and that's when I look at the dwarf team that's got that like semi-tank death roller thing.
It is a death roller.
It reminds me of the you remember the old 5th edition orc death rollers on the battle wagons? Do you remember those,
yeah.
Paul?
Oh yeah.
They just like run people over and mulch them.
This thing's been a staple in Blood Bowl for a long time, and it's gone through really kind of different iterations, and this is one of the cooler ones though. I mean, they've all looked cool, but I like the way this one turned out.
I just don't know how they keep their beards out of the grinder.
Well,
I work around printing presses. Like, That's a real legitimate concern.
I bet they have whole manuals on that.
I wonder if you can hold a grudge against a machine.
I think dwarves can hold a grudge against anything.
That, well said.
You tell me, though. You'll have to tell me if that's incorporated into the Caragrons.
Oh, dude, when we're ready to go into that, I'm more than happy. I've been marinating in new Sigmar story. My War Scroll room is not as big as the Librarius I have in the Archangelicum, but I'm getting there.
We're going to do a whole show on that. We're not going to talk about it on this broadcast, but we do. A couple of weeks ago, we released an Age of Sigmar show that was dedicated all to Age of Sigmar. We're going to do another one very soon.
Yeah, I've got three lists ready that I'm sending out to all of my Sigmar expert buddies to critique, just because that's going to inform my purchases. And I'm very excited to talk about them on that Sigmar show.
I hope it's like dwarves attached to metal balloons, because those look cool.
Oh, well, I've got some of them in there. You can believe it.
Okay.
I'm not bursting your bubble.
Oh, good Lord. Well, if you listened to the last show, you kind of got an idea of everything we got from the live Q&A for 40K 8th edition. And we've had a few more actual truths released specifically from Games Workshop. They have promised us, I shouldn't say promised, they've said they're going to put out routine, hopefully daily updates leading up to whenever we're going to get this new edition.
Well, so far so good. I mean, who knows how long it's going to be till the new edition is out. But every day they've had something that has had, basically my Facebook notifications are thinking of going on strike.
I have a prediction. I think maybe this coming week, by the time you hear this, if not the following weekends, White Dwarf will have all 12 pages of 40K rulebooks. That's my prediction. Don't hold me to it, but that's what I think is going to happen.
Well,
because GW is all about anniversaries.
Even if it's wishful thinking, I'm on board with you. I absolutely hope so. Yesterday,
I'd love to see it.
Yeah, yesterday we got some stats. Now, we saw some unit stats. We saw a Dreadnought, and we saw a Tac Marine, we saw Gilliman and Terminators.
It's a safe bet, right? Release the Space Marine stuff first because it's the most generic, the easiest baseline. I mean, everyone's familiar with the colloquial MEQ, you know, Marine equivalent sort of shorthand that people talk about online when they're discussing lists. So it makes total sense for them to be like, this gun that everybody knows what a bolt gun is, everybody knows what a Space Marine stat line is, this is what it's going to look like, and kind of guess fairly accurately how their stuff is going to turn out if they play Filthy Xenos.
It's actually the 30th anniversary of Warhammer 40K. And who is the poster child of Warhammer 40K? None other than the Space Marines. And they have to be at the forefront here.
Well, what I was surprised to see was that the Marine had a movement of 5 inches. I think that
The Marine had a movement of 6. The Terminators had a movement of 5.
My apologies. Yes, Marine's movement of 6. That was surprising to me because now look, I've only got my old age and to fall back on from experience from when the last time we had movement values, I believed that the Marines didn't move 6. I could be wrong. I thought it was a 4 or 5 movement rate for Marines, and then Eldar were faster, like inherently, like a Guardian moves 6 or something like that.
But Gilliman's back, so they're riled up. They're ready to go.
Maybe they'll get a little more pep in their step.
Yeah, they have to.
Well, I remember in the article itself, it mentions how a Guardsman will not run as fast as an Eldar, who will not run as fast as a Hormagaunt. So I'm wondering if the real difference in speed for a lot of these, we're going to see more in how far they can run. You know, that's me looking at the word and saying, well, it says run. It could be
implying
meaning
that
the actual
mechanic, right?
Run is run is a mechanic, or is it, you know, do they mean running as in that's how fast they move across the table? So we don't know.
They do speak English differently than we do, so there's no telling. I don't want to necessarily get too far in the speculation, except for the fact that you could be right, because that would help things cover distance. It wouldn't necessarily affect charge momentum if that was something that they were worried about, balance. There's some implications there.
So yeah, I mean, it's exciting, and of course I seem to remember this interview you did, Paul, with some of the rules guys at Adepticon, where you kind of gave them a little nudge about a certain Papa Smurf having a hard time getting across the table.
They fixed that.
It seems so.
Well, he's got 9 inches. He is 8 inches. He moves 8 inches.
Still, and whatever his charge roll is. But do we know how the charge mechanic is going to work? Do we have any evidence
We don't have any info on that. All that we know is that the chargers should be able to have the initiative to go first. There's no initiative step in this anymore. If you look at the profiles, initiative is gone completely. So what we've replaced it with is that if you charge, you're going to swing first unless you're interrupted with some command points, and we'll talk about that as we move forward with.
Oh, I tell you what, the Thunder Hammer Storm Shield Terminators that I've been working on are really excited about that.
Yeah, no kidding. So let's look at, since I kind of botched the movement characteristic before, let's look at the humble profile of a Space Marine, and then we'll look at a Dreadnought, because the Dreadnought, they kind of gave us this, is that, you know, no armor value anymore. It's going to have toughness and a certain amount of wounds. So a Space Marine movement 6, weapon skill. This weapon skill now has been replaced with a flat number, so it hits on a 3+. Ballistic skill also hits on a 3+. Strength 4, toughness 4, 1 wound, 1 attack, leadership 7 with a 3+ save. So that is just your basic Space Marine. Dreadnought, movement 6, weapon skill BS 3+, strength 6, toughness 7, 8 wounds, 4 attacks, leadership 8, and then 3+ save.
Yeah. So aside from the obvious, like, oh look, Dreadnoughts finally have toughness, it's like everyone has been asking for the last, you know, 4 editions. He has a leadership value.
Yeah, and an armor save.
Yeah, and no hating on an armor save, that's for sure.
I think this is, with the 8 wounds, now we know that weapons are going to have variable damage that they can output, especially the larger ones that are meant for killing things like dreadnoughts. But with a 3+ save and 8 wounds, we're not going to see, I think, a lot of, you know, one and done's out of this guy.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
It might be like a whole unit of las cannons blowing them to bits, but
that's expected though, right? I think we can all kind of like be at peace with that.
Yeah. I think so too. I'm okay with that.
Even with the last cannons, he's going to get saves.
Right. He's got his 3-up armor save, and he will get a 6-up save based on my interpretation of the rules today. He will get a 6-up save against those last cannons.
Yeah, we'll talk about the weapon profiles here in a couple of minutes, because I think that's going to give us a kind of spin off into more conversation. We should see them now on the table, I think, for sure. I think we're going to see this kind of stuff.
That's what I'm getting at. Thank you.
You could start it on the line and, in my mind right now, conceivably, you know, get it into charge range. Who knows? We'll see. So then, you know, that's what it kind of tells us, that it's going to be very difficult to wound certain things, and that stats won't be capped at 10. And I think that what that means is specifically like wounds. Wounds won't be capped at 10. I guess we could even, you know, we could even go so far as to say maybe strength and toughness won't be capped at
10. They've already said that strength will not be capped at 10.
Yeah, and then...
I mean, the biggest thing that's kind of a giveaway for how high they're willing to take this, you know, since they've bust through that ceiling... They talk about knights, imperial knights having, and land raiders having dozens of wounds. Like dozens. That's not a small number.
It is not.
Not in the context of, hey, your land raider has 4 hull points and just got stuck on a route.
My opinion, I think the land raider is going to be about 16 to 18 wounds. I think an imperial knight's going to be 24. That's just my estimation.
Could be.
You I guys can't wait to see.
Correct me if I'm wrong. If I'm right,
I mean, guys, we're all guessing. So you know, one guess is as good as another right now. Right. So Gilliman, back to that movement 8. I apologize for saying a different kind of movement earlier. Weapon skill, ballista skill 2+. Strength 6, toughness 6. Now, we know he's going to have war gear that does different things, right? Wounds 9, attack 6, leadership 10 with a 2+ save.
So I imagine that leadership's probably still going to cap at 10, but here's a big thing about that. He hits on 2s. When was the last time you can remember anyone except Karn hitting on 2s?
I like Gilliman hitting on 2s. So I, again, as somebody who's been playing Gilliman since he was released, I like this so much better. Even if he doesn't get his ability to come back.
Oh, that'll be there. I mean, I don't think anything. So? I don't think anything's going to functionally change with. I should say not functionally. Things aren't going to thematically change too much with the stats. I don't believe, and so I think that is something very inherent to the theme of the character.
Cool. I mean, I'm okay with that.
Again, just guessing. It's just one guess as good as another, right? The increase in wounds is really nice. That means, you know, on what's the average roll? 2 last cannon shots to get through are going to do 7 wounds. So it's going to take a 3rd last cannon to even see about dropping him, and he's going to get a save against that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be something very interesting to see exactly how high some of these weapons are going to go. Because one of the things that they talked about, you know, the death of D weapons, et cetera, et cetera. We still don't know how far they're willing to push the wound counter. Is it always going to stay on a D6? Is it always going to be D6 wounds? Is it going to be a 2D6 wounds? How are things like feel no pain and instant death going to change? Like, man, there's so much they're telling us in comparison to what they've told us in the past, but there's still so much we don't know.
The only thing I'm really skeptical on, like, of just that I'm like, oh, come on, guys, is this D-weapon stuff. Because if the D-weapons follow the same path, like, say, we'll look at the last cannon, that's where I want to wait a minute to talk about that stuff until we get to the weapons, if that's okay. But sure. Terminators, 2 wounds. Marine stat line, 2+ save, 2 wounds.
I need to go on mute for a second while I celebrate.
So I think, and I'm going to pat myself on the back here, I think one of my first episodes, and somebody can fact check us, we were talking about who knows what, but I said something along the lines of Terminators need to be 2 wounds to be effective. And I am so happy and so pleased to see this. Am I going to play them? Probably not. But for all those people that have been collecting Terminators because they're such great models and they've always wanted to make them work, this, in my opinion, makes them a lot more viable. And if Games Workshop gives them 2 dice, 2d6 to save, holy crap, we're going to be seeing a lot of Terminators at tournaments. And
as a true believer who never stopped playing Terminators... This makes me so very happy. And I know I feel greedy at wanting at least 3 wounds on them, but the fact that, you know, 2 is there, that means, Paul, maybe you can dust off those gold paladins you have.
Well,
maybe
they'll have 3 wounds.
Yeah.
This just brings nothing but hope. I'm telling you, this stat line, recognizing Terminators are a big part of, I mean, they're integral to things like Dark Angels. They're integral to Grey Knights. They're even a big part of the Space Marine art. I mean, every Marine chapter has some type of Terminator, I think, formation or something attached to it. And so getting them to actually off the shelves and onto the table, I think, is going to be good for the game because those are great looking figures.
And there's two ways to know if you're dealing with a real, you know, bad A dude. First thing, does he have a plasma pistol? Second thing, is he in Terminator armor? If he's one of those two things, you know this guy's cool and you'll never see him on the table.
Maybe so. Maybe you will coming up, man. So I think now's a good time to talk about all this change. Games Workshop has done something unprecedented in their history. They've given us this advance notice of a giant change coming. I'm not saying that they shouldn't have done it. I'm saying that they have not done it in the past, but they've definitely done it this time, and they've given a grace period that if you have bought any of the codexes and have proof of purchase, you know, in the form of receipt, you can contact customer service and they will give you vouchers for up to the value of what you paid for future purchases in 8th.
Yeah, and it isn't just at a GW store. It is at your local hobby store. Even iTunes receipts count for this sort of thing.
That's pretty big. That is something they didn't have to do. And that even kind of speaks, I think, that you know, we're probably going to see 8th sooner than we think, because I bet people are kind of in like buyer confusion right now. And that's not, you know, that's not what anybody wants to have when you're a business.
Yeah, it's kind of like what you and Horton were talking about in the mini episode of Doom, where you're basically saying like they need to sell books and they don't want to go without selling books for a long time, and they probably don't want to hand out too many of those vouchers. I mean, it's great that they're doing that. I don't think that they're resentful of that, but from a bottom line perspective, they want to be able to deliver a new product into people's hands as soon as possible to make up for the fact that, you know, they could have just said no, right? They could have said no. I mean, haha, gotcha, suckers.
Or 4 weeks from the release date or whatever. No, they're making it 8 weeks from the announcement from a few days ago. Again, it feels like forever ago, but it was just a little while ago. You can claim this benefit, which I think is awesome.
Yeah. Good on them for doing that. I'm very happy that they are. I'm just so encouraged by a lot of what I'm seeing on their customer service and their community interaction. And we've been singing their praises for a long time now, but they haven't disappointed us.
Yeah, and then we're taking just a kind of a break from our normal fare of talking about efficiencies and strategies and that side of the hobby, because it's going to be very difficult to kind of put this all together until we get more of a picture. So if you guys listening can just kind of indulge us on the fan side. I mean, not that we are not all gushing about this, but really excited, and it's going to be cool to talk about this kind of stuff leading up to whenever we do get some real concrete info.
And that's kind of an interesting thing for me, because I am running a GT coming up here locally at the Salt Lake Gaming Con, and the GT is in July, and the plan was, well, we're just going to play 7th no matter what. But if they keep progressing this fast and we get an announcement for New Hammer in enough time to prep for it, I might just switch it over to start the new thing right away. I mean, I kind of want to give people time, because I know people like to build lists in advance, right? And 7th edition isn't dead yet. We shouldn't bury it before it's dead. This isn't Monty Python. So what do you think? What do you guys think about that? As event attendees and organizers, tell me how you feel about, do you want to play it as soon as it drops?
Man,
or do you want,
I'm the wrong person,
want the buffer?
To ask for your logistics.
I want to play it. Personally, I want to play it as soon as it drops. And I kind of stuff. We've got ATC around the corner. I know it's really early to be talking about it, but it's really not. I think ATC always gets the butt end of the stick when it comes to GW releases, because, you know, new releases are always within 3 to 4 weeks right before the event starts. You know, I want to play 8th edition. I'll play any edition that they want me to, but I really want to play the new edition. So we've been fanboys of everything. Obviously, we were huge fans of 7th edition. We liked where everything went. We were big believers in rulebook 40K. But when, if you look at all of the websites, Bela Lost Souls, any of the other ones that are out there, and you look through the comments, when could you have seen such positive response regarding Warhammer 40,000, as we have seen?
I think there's definitely reason to be hopeful right now. And just from what we've seen, it looks like that there is kind of a call to make more things playable. And I think that their idea, at least one of the visions behind this release, is to make everything playable. You know, they've got a whole line of products at the base of it. At the brass tacks. They have a whole line of products. I'm willing to bet that not everything moves in a way similar to the thing next to it on the shelf. And a way to make everybody have more fun is to utilize all the different toys on the shelf.
Well, and let me just mention how I have been speaking to my brother. My brother's been out of the game since the beginning of 6th edition. And I've been trying to get him to play the game with me again for a long time. And I've been very persistent at it. But it wasn't until some of these announcements started coming out that he started getting back interested in it. And I know not everybody's going to be happy about what's going on, right? We kind of take that for granted when we're talking about it. But the fact
and Chris,
that,
if I can also mention, there's just going to be some people that just voice their displeasure, even if they're going to buy at the same rate that we do.
Yeah. Or people that, you know, never had any intention of buying that just feel like raining on everybody's parade. But, where it's getting people and several people that I know that have in the past said, I'm not really interested in this anymore. It just seems too complicated. Now they're looking at it and saying, well, now this is approachable again.
Well, I mean, look at that. Games Workshop is bringing families back together.
Cue the music, folks.
There you go. We are going to take a quick break here in a minute, and I'm going to bring in a segment from me and I'll just let you know. We'll see if I get the segment done in time to put in between this. But then right after that segment, we're going to come back and do the second half of the show, talk about a bunch of weapons and the profiles and what we think that that's going to mean as this stuff progresses.
Sounds good.
FTN is brought to you by Bell of Lost Souls. Check out www.bols.org for the best daily hobby articles on the web.
Hey everybody, welcome to a very special section of Forge Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. I'm joined today by Doug Johnson.
Hey, how's it going?
Doug, man, thanks for joining me.
No problem.
There could be any number of reasons why we have you on the show right now. You're the purveyor of Table War. You've been a graphic designer for a long time and done properties that some of us know and love.
Yep.
You're a great competitor.
I try to.
Yeah. I mean, any number of reasons, but I want to talk to you today specifically about, of course, Table War. I was actually just discussing a couple days ago with someone about how that Table War is definitely a premium product. You get a lot of I guess value and options built into one thing that happens to also store your army and travel.
Well, yeah, we have the cases, and then of course I'm the creator of the Fat Mat as well. So there is the Table War cases, which is the army transport case, the mats, the fat mats, and then now the macro mats for photographing your stuff as well.
It's a premium, especially premium quality, amazing products.
Thank you.
But you also are a competitor, as just mentioned. And this is not the first time you've made it up into the top 16 at Adepticon.
No, it was the fourth time.
So obviously a trend. It's not by random. You're actually doing something. So I want to talk to you about that. Like, how'd you come up with the list that you took? How have you been so consistently good in this I want to say almost like it's not a random format, but there are lots of roles, lots of things that can go wrong with someone's performance. Tell me about again your whole process.
Well, first it comes down to what's the format of the event. And so that was a tough thing for me this year with Adepticon and, changing stuff up. Adepticon runs a little different than some of the other formats. I love Adepticon. But, when you're used to a format and then you go jump to another format, you can make mistakes. You can outlist build yourself if you're not careful. I had that problem with IG all the time back when I used to play Imperial Guard, is there's so many fun toys to play with. To really fine tune your list can be an issue sometimes. And now that I'm doing Space Marines, there's tons of things you can do there with all the allies and all that kind of stuff. But when I was looking at the format that they had, I was planning on taking my orcs. I wanted to take my orcs, but they weren't going to let me use a Stompa. So just the way they did their Lords
the
of War.
Value, right?
Yeah, it was the point value Lords of War. They weren't going to allow the cheaper Stompa. But the way it worked out, people could take two Wraith Knights. So I was kind of bummed about that. But it was playtesting those missions and looking at the missions, I loved the Adepticon missions. They were really fun. If anybody out there hasn't tried them, download their primers and play them. They're pretty fun. I like the, Eternal War in every mission. So objectives in every mission. Capping, every mission has up to 12 kill points. And each one of those, so Eternal War is worth 12 points, the kill points is worth a max of 12 points. And then they had the Maelstrom missions. The way they had them was there's 12 different ones you could pick from, and you can only pick two a turn. And if you don't achieve those that turn, you can never pick them again.
Oh, that's pretty interesting.
So it was really fun. There's a lot of tactics involved. So I was like, okay, well, what do I want to play? There's no orcs. I could do Space Marines and bring my Conclave like I do, but I didn't want to do that either. And I knew a lot of people were going to be bringing a lot of Death Stars because that's kind of the thing right now. So I went the complete opposite, and I went zero Death Star, no Death Star whatsoever. And I went just maxed out my Gladius as much as I could. So it was really, you know, the title of my list was Gladius Cheesius Maximus. So I had 27 OBSEC units, 30 kill points, but my opponents could only get a max of 12.
Well,
so.
I mean, I'm not even going to fault or say anything about the list design. I think it's very well done and plays to the format. With a maximum on kill points, why not get as many as you can, and why not pay for as few of them as possible?
Right. So, you know, I knew I'd be giving up the kill point part of that at probably every game, right? But I would also be getting some kill points. So it was how many points ahead are they going to be on me on that one? Where, you know, the Eternal War with a lot of the Death Stars, a lot of non-OBSEC formations out there, you know, having all that OBSEC on those objectives was going to give me the advantage on the Eternal War part. And then also, you know, at least half of the Maelstrom missions, you know, had to do with capping objectives, you know, a certain amount of objectives. And if you looked at the Maelstrom missions, you know, prior to, you know, deployment, you know, there's a lot of tactics involved in where you put those objectives, because you get more, you know, like one of them, you got 2 points if you could hold two objectives outside of your deployment zone, let's say. So I think on average, they had two, sometimes three of those Maelstrom missions were 2 points each. The rest were all one. So there's a lot of tactics there. And because I was seeing all the potential for tactics, I was like, all right, I'm going to run a lot, you know, a heavy, you know, OBSEC heavy kill point list, but it's going to give me the ability to really have some fun with some tactics and try to manipulate the board and manipulate the game and kind of the flow of the game with all these Death Stars. Now, all my testing that I did beforehand was all against, Xenos armies, you know, Eldar and the new Eldar,
the Super Wraith Knights, Skitatch Wraith Knights. Yes, the new Gathering Storm, Yanari.
Yeah,
all those. Yep.
So I practiced against that, and I practiced against some Riptide Wing stuff, and then I ended up playing all Imperial Death Stars for every game I played was versus an Imperial Death Star. So Celestine in every list. Either a bike star with Iron Hands, or I did play against a 5 Centurion squad with, I don't know, I think there were like 9 independent characters in it.
Competing on that level, though, there people are looking for value. And so, of course, they're going to pick these things. I mean, you know, we know what you took, and I think it's fair to assume other people are going to take something similar.
Absolutely. So, you know, knowing that people are going to bring stuff like that, you know, I knew I had to play a certain kind of game, a little bit of a cagey game. You know, I don't want to throw everything, you know, I want to spread some stuff out, you know, manipulate them, draw them into an area that maybe doesn't have the objectives in it, stuff like that with their Death Stars. Round 2, I lost it in a super close game.
You want to like present like a sweet basket of kill points for them to pick up that's nowhere near an objective.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, you draw them away from the, you know, I'm running the White Scars formation, so I can outflank if I wanted to, which was nice on the Hammer and Anvil mission, because then I just swarmed both sides. I made sure I put all of my objectives outside of my deployment zone so I could max out on those, you know, those 2-point maelstroms as well. So all my games were close. They're fun. It was tough at times, but, you know, after I lost round 2, I was under the assumption it was like the win-loss draw, right? So it's like, oh, okay, I lost, I'm out. And then I went to my 3rd game, and I kind of played really loose and stupid and scouted forward even though he was going first, because I'm like, yeah, it's, you know, whatever, it's over. And he's like, no, it's not. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, it's battle points this time. It's not win, loss, draw. We're both totally in it. Did you get a lot of points in your last game that you lost? I was like, oh, yeah, I got a ton. You know, I got quite a few. He's like, yeah, we're both in it. And I'm like, uh-oh. And I had to like recheck the board. I'm like, oh, how am I getting out of this one? But I fought back. I mean, he had the Death Star with bikes, Iron Hands, but he took the new Inquisition formation. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, where the troops keep coming back to, you know, on a five
the
up.
Castellan.
Yeah, the Castellan. So he had that going for him. So he had a bunch of bikes, but a lot of my rhinos and razorbacks, mostly razorbacks, you know, seven razorbacks in there, shooting a bunch of twin linked heavy bolters at them. You know, he was rolling ones and twos. I was able to kill him. I did some silly moves at the beginning to try to get back and try to push him and keep him in his corner so I could slowly draw up to the objectives. And then I got him, and that was a tough fight back. Yeah, I think he felt pretty good until turn four. I think that's when we started realizing, okay, I had a shot at it. But turn two was really bad for me. And turn three, I was kind of fighting, but it was fun. So, you know, going through all of those Death Stars with, you know, my list, for example, for people that didn't know, is it's all five-man troop squads, melt the guns with the tac squads in their free Razorbacks. And then every sergeant in my army had a melt a bomb. I had the two command squads and bikes, con on a bike, and then I had the hunter's eye in a dev squad, with my chaplain. So it was pretty good, you know, two dreadnoughts and drop pods, and then a five-man squad with a melta combi melta in a drop pod. So I had three drop pods, and the rest was all razorback and rhino, two rhinos, seven razorbacks.
I do prefer two the bike squads list with a few pods in there, just in case.
I mean, a couple times I'd have to throw them away if I just wanted to go for the nice thing is with the Maelstrom missions, the way they are, if you got a null deployer or you have, you know, somebody that does just, you know, they have that Death Star out and that's it, turn one, I can pick the, you know, both or all three of those 2-point Maelstrom missions, or I can pick two of the three, or sometimes if there was only two, I could pick those two, turn one, with my scouting that I had and with the two drop pods, you know, I could grab those. So now, you know, it's his turn, you know, it's the bottom of one, and I've already got four Maelstrom missions and I've got the board covered with OPSEC. So, you know, they've got a tough time coming back from that. So, you know, are you going for kill points against me? You know, that's not enough. You've got to be able to get those objectives. So it was tough for some of these Death Stars to deal with.
I think that
my game in
that.
The final was really close.
I think people could listen to that and you going through the list and go, well, of course he did so well. But no, I mean, there's a lot of thought that goes into that. And people have to recognize that the opponent is also trying to do everything they possibly can to keep you from doing what you want to do. But you it sounds like you had a really good mix of things in the army to counter threats, but more importantly, to move and navigate through the missions themselves.
Exactly. You know, you can have, when you have that many kill points out there, you don't want to feed, you know, four, five, six a turn to one of those big giant Death Stars that could, you know, charge all that and take it on. That's kind of what happened to me round five in the finals. Was like I was feeding him a unit that was really far away from the objectives, but it was, you know, one he could assault to, and it was about a 9-inch charge. Now there were four other units that were about 12 inches away, just over 11, right around 11, 12 inches away. And basically he would need a 12-inch charge to make all those, and he did. So that was tough. That was tough. I had I tried to tank shock and do a little horseshoe surround on him to keep him in the corner away from the objectives. Unfortunately, you know, he was running the Death Star with some summoning, and then I'm running the big, you know, massive kill point. So there's a lot of, you know, maneuvering going on. So we didn't get very far in our turn, unfortunately for me. But you know, that happens in tournaments too. So I'm not saying anything. It just happens. And I hope that's kind of a change that happens with 8th, is more games will finish. Cause I had one game out of five go to completion.
That's rough. Sometimes on both sides of it.
It's rough. You know, I made this list because of that. You know, when I have 27 OPSEC units, it's up to my opponent to go faster, right? And I don't really have a lot to do maneuver wise, as long as, you know, as long as I'm repositioning my Razorbacks and my Rhinos. Usually the guys stay inside. A couple times, you know, I jump everybody out, do a bunch of shooting, jump them back in and drive away, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
So a lot, you know, when I took out my summoning, I took out my conclave. So I didn't have to worry about the psychic phase. So I wasn't too worried about that. Yeah, I was throwing everything on the board most of the times. So, and I was usually just driving around with my Rhinos and Razorbacks, you know, with two small bike squads. So, you know, I had a lot of stuff moving around, but it was really quick. And it was, you know, my movement, my shooting, I didn't really have a lot of assault punch. So I didn't have to really worry, you know, I wasn't focusing on assault, on assaulting anything.
Models, you know, in that
yeah.
Situation.
So, you know, just using my tactical doctrines properly. That was key. You know, a couple times, you know, just making sure I was in position, jumping everybody out so I could get all that twin link double shot stuff going. And I'm notorious for failing melta shots if I don't do my doctrine. I'm like, nah, I just need one of these four meltas to do something. Oh, wait, I missed three out of the four. Okay, awesome.
That's the life I lead as well.
Exactly. Well, but, you know, it was fun. I had a blast. And, you know, I was expecting going up against Death Stars, so I wasn't, you know, shocked about that.
With the time we have left, I want to talk about that you also are big and largely involved in the community in your area. I'm talking about with leagues and other play setup things. Can you tell me about that and anybody who may be in the area and curious? First, tell them exactly where you are and then everything that you organize.
Okay, well, I'm in San Diego, California. We have a league down here at Game Empire that's been going for years, decades, really. I took it over probably about 4 years ago now. And that's our Wednesday league. And now I'm also running the Masters, which I've told you about. And, you know, that's an exciting one. Unfortunately, I just got knocked out of it. But the Masters is fun because every game you can change your list. So it's 2,000 points, you know, as many Force Orgs as you want. You pick your primary codex. Your Warlord always has to come from that. Your majority of your points has to come from that codex over any others. So if you had like four codexes, you know, I'm Space Marines, right? My Space Marine points would have to be more than any other. Like, you know, if I was going to go Tau with Space Marines or something like that, or Inquisition. So, but the nice thing is, so we get everybody put into divisions, and then you play everybody in your division. That's how the league starts. Every game you play, you can switch up your list.
With those same restrictions involved.
With all those same restrictions, right?
Okay.
So you're doing that, you're playing all your division games, and after division games, then you get put into the playoff brackets, and there's the gold bracket, and then there's the silver bracket, not the loser bracket, just the silver bracket. So once you go into those, then you go, it's basically kind of like the World Cup. So you're going through those, but when you get to the semifinals and finals, they're three game series. So
against the same opponent.
So let's say you and I were in the semifinals against each other. I'm primary Space Marines. Let's say you're primary Chaos. Every game we play, we can switch up our lists. But you know, you still keep your same primaries. Warlord comes from the primary. All that.
Blind. Like I don't get to see your
list. It's blind.
Just you.
No,
come,
well,
come
nope.
In.
Not till we show up. So yeah. We show up. We use the ITC missions this Masters. So you show up, you roll off, and you play that mission. Unless you both decide, you know, choose to play a specific mission, you can do that too. The nice thing about the Masters is every game's played to completion because you guys schedule your games on your own. It's definitely a gentleman's league. You guys show up. If there's a rules question, they text me or text the other TO, Cooper, initially to figure out, you know, any kind of rules disputes or whatever. But usually people figure it out, usually just dice it off, whatever. But you basically have, we give you 2 weeks to play each game. So it's a long, that the Masters is long.
How many folks are involved in this?
There's 30 players in the Masters.
I mean, that's great.
It's intense. It gets, you know, we have a Masters Facebook page. You can look at it. People can look at it if they want. But you can only be a member in it if you're in that Masters
season. What's the name of the page?
So, right, it is called the Masters Grand Tournament. Masters Grand Tournament League San Diego.
Got it. Okay.
So you can go there, check it out. We've got the brackets up right now. Cooper posted them. So anybody can look at it. And, you know, the fun thing is I make up a weird ways every season to put people in divisions. So this time we did like shuffleboard. So there was a shuffleboard. We all met at like Tilted Kilt, had some beers, played some shuffleboard to figure out what division you were in. Right. So The guys that place the highest last masters go first, and then they get put into their divisions. Then the guys that either didn't play or knew or were at the bottom go second on the shuffle, you know, shuffleboarding it. And then the, so they throw a couple, and they throw a couple of their pegs or whatever they're called. I don't even know what they're called in shuffleboard, but then they get the, you know, whichever they land on, they can pick between those to decide what division they want in, to try to dodge some of the top players or whatever. And then all the guys in the middle go last. So it's pretty fun. So you go in the division, we hang out and have food or whatever. And then we also have a bunch of raffle tickets. So you get a raffle ticket every time you post your game, you know, a bat rep. If you do a cool bat rep, you know, you get a raffle ticket. And then at the end of the league and in the middle and the end of the league, we meet up and do, you know, I have a bunch of prize support that I've collected and we'll give out for people. So you don't even, you know, you don't even need to be a winner in the Masters to win something from the raffle. We've got some pretty big, yeah, for sure. Oh, well, I mean, the whoever gets first is going to get $400 cash plus a bunch of prizes. Like every division winner, yeah, every division winner got a prize. I got my buddy at War Gamma. He gave us a bunch of his stuff, like his defense lines and stuff like that. So everybody got to pick which defense, all the division winners got to pick their defense line that they wanted from him. So, you know, he's got the cool Chaos ones or the Eldar ones or the Tau looking ones. So they all got those for winning their division. Then they'll have a division trophy, and we'll have a big trophy for whoever wins the finals. But we also have his big giant bug, which is, I don't know, $200-something bug that people are going to be able to win as a raffle prize at the end as well. So it kind of keeps people motivated to stay along. The silver bracket, you know, keeps everybody in, you know, that didn't make it into the gold players playoff bracket. So it's super fun. And it's supposed to be kind of a community type thing where it's not just we go grind out X amount of games over the weekend. You know, we're constantly posting on there. A lot of smack talk going on. Cooper does like little predictions on, you know, who's going to win what game and stuff like that. And everybody, you know, makes fun of him for that. It's just a blast. It's different type of way of playing.
Yeah. But then we also do. I definitely suggest folks contact you immediately after hearing this to try to get involved.
Well, yeah, I'm also, you know, I'm redefining the format too, because people want to start playing it in their areas. So, you know, if anybody wants to try it out, you know, contact me and I'll walk you through it. It's pretty fun. And the nice, you know, the thing that I really enjoy is it's 2000 points. So you're playing with more toys. You mix up your list, you know, I completely changed my list for my last game, but my opponent did too. Right. So you get that thing where like, he's always playing this list. So I'm going to switch it up. And then you go up and then he switched his up. You're like, but it's still the dynamics of it is really fun because you really are building these lists that you would never take to, you know, LVO or Adepticon, right? Where you've got to do the most ultimate list you can against, you know, you don't know what you're going to come up against, right? It's the all comers lists. With the Masters, you don't have to do that. You know, okay, Cooper's playing, his primary is, you know, knights. Okay, I know I'm going up against some knights. What am I going to bring? And then he knows I've got Space Marines and I've been running Gladius. So what is he going to bring against me, you know, to go with it? So he brings three knights and a Riptide wing with some Inquisition or something like that. So, you know, it's just like these random fun lists. And, you know, people get crazy with it too and switch it up. And sometimes it can burn you. It can burn you bad sometimes.
Dude, this sounded awesome.
But so the Wednesday League is, you know, a 6-week league that I've been running at Game Empire for the last 3 years. And, you know, it's been going for decades. And that one, we mix it up. You know, we'll do like ITC LVO prep league. So it's every Wednesday for 6 weeks. And then this league, we're doing like a total random crazy one where I gave everybody a chariot. So they're pimping out their chariots. So you get 1500 points. They get 1500 base points to build their list. And then they get a chariot and a charioteer. And then every week they win within the game, they win points to buy upgrades for their chariot. So, you know, we've got, and I made like 6 different types of chariots from an, you know, Imperial chariot, Demon's chariot, of course. There's an Eldar chariot, a Dark Eldar chariot, an Orc chariot. So they've all got these base stats and now people are building them up. And this league, we're going to a seventh week, and the seventh week is we're going to have a chariot race. So everybody has these invulnerable chariots now. Like, one's got a Librarius Conclave on his chariot. Another one's got a monstrous creature with the black mace on his chariot. You know, there's a couple demon chariots. Yeah, so there's all these crazy chariots going on, and there's going to be this giant race on three of the fat mats. So it's up and back again. And I've got all these different stats and different things that are going to happen with the race. So, you know, you're either going to be shooting each other. Like, some of the chariots have sponson upgrades on them. So it'll be fun. So, you know, we mix that one up because it's half casual players, half competitive players, you know, that, you know, they want to, there's a definite mix of players at the league. So anybody that wants to come by on Wednesday nights at Game Empire San Diego, come on by and say hi.
Sounds pretty cool, man. How can, if someone's curious about anything we've talked about tonight, how can somebody get a hold of you?
They can just message me on my Facebook, Warboss Doug, D-U-G-G. I'm friends with you if they want to find me through your friends or whatever. You can also just go to Table War, the Table War Facebook, and message me there as well. And then we're also Table War Designs at Twitter. You can message me there.
Sounds like fine options.
Yeah.
Dude, it's been great talking to somebody that, I mean, you really are. You're a scholar of the game, an active participant with the community, and you bring great products to us, man.
Oh, yeah, and we just brought two new ones. We've got our new Ruined City Fat Mat and our new Tundra Fat Mat. So tableware.com, we got distribution all through Europe, Australia, and North America. So check us out, guys.
Dude, man, it's been great talking to you.
Thanks for having me on, Paul.
Have a good night.
All right, take care.
You're listening to Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody, we are back. I'm still Paul. I got Chris and Adam with me.
Yo.
What's up, y'all?
So I promise we're going to talk about weapons. But before I do that, I also want to mention that the SoCal GT is coming up. We're going to talk about this as the sponsor for the Finishing Moves, but I wanted to make sure that you guys, it didn't all run.
The SoCal Open?
Yep, the SoCal Open. Registration starts on May 1st. They've got a giant hall, what I understand is a beautiful venue right near the water. It is going to be a destination event, if you ask me, obviously put on by Frontline and those guys. By the time you guys hear this, registration is either about to be on sale or just went on sale. I mean, I suggest going for sure. Okay, so weapons. We have limited info, but what we've got, I think, speaks some volumes. We have the Flamer, which I think is actually the most interesting one here. We have which is range 8.
Agreed.
Assault D6. That's why it's interesting. Assault D6 with an 8-inch range, strength 4, damage 1 with no AP. And what they're using the AP is the Rend, if you're familiar with Age of Sigmar. It's the neg to armor save. It's going to give you, that's where your armor save modifier is going to be in this AP category. And this says this weapon automatically hits its target. So that's kind of cool.
So it's saving that. Yeah, on a D6, you roll a D6 within 8 inches. If you roll a 5, you've hit 5 models.
You hit 5 times. You've scored 5 hits. Maybe not hit 5
right,
models,
right, right.
But you have 5 hits. So you could technically hit one model 6 times.
Right.
That is an interesting point right there, Paul. The fact that, hey, now you're basically just giving someone a Promethean bath and seeing how long they last.
Hosing them down, right?
Yep.
But this is this 8-inch. Now, the Flamer template was 8 inches long. I shouldn't say was. It still is, right? Still technically 7th edition. 8 inches long. So, but before, if you drop that template and you're 8 inches away, you're not hitting anybody. You're hitting one person. Or you may be able to kind of squeak it to hit 2. This is a D6 roll. Now, sometimes you're going to get 1. But, you know, average roll is 3-4 hits.
So one of the only things that, in my opinion, and I've been playing a lot of Flamers, heavy Flamers in my lists, is that now I can't clip other units if I need to. I can't manipulate the template, which could be a good thing.
Well,
I don't know.
Think it's good for playability. I think we can all agree that we've all done it. I'm not saying there's like an unspoken rule that it was okay, that was sporting. you know what I'm saying, right? I think everyone's got a little bit of the feel bads from that.
I feel you.
But, you know, I think that's a small price to pay for getting that maximum effect, even at the longest range.
I mean, you do what you got to do, man, right? Like, to get that effect out, you do what you need to.
Yeah, but so, I think that the D6 here at that max range is going to be, I mean, this is the magnitude of efficiency increase to the Humble Flamer. As we mentioned, seemingly you could even hit a single model D6 times. That means, you know, you could put six wounds on a dreadnought. Is it happening? No. But that's what it seems like you might be able to do.
Well, just think about the mighty Pyrovore. Is the mighty Pyrovore relevant again? We have no idea. But isn't it fun to think about?
It is fun to think about. It's fun to think about, you know, like Blood Angels with heavy flamers on them. That,
well,
you
know, I know. That's where I was going to go with this. I mean, they're probably going to have an armor modifier to it, or a save modifier at strength 5. I have to guess they're going to remain at strength 5. I cannot wait for flamer templates after the new release.
Yeah, and then how does this apply to, you know, a mortar, where a mortar was a blast template? Or we're kind of assuming that we'll see things like, you know, and this is just, but maybe a mortar is D3, maybe a wyvern is D3 plus 3 hits, maybe a quad mortar is, you know, just a straight D6. You know, I think they're going to kind of stress and flex that the functionality of a D6 throughout all of these weapons to kind of make them creative and all have a different type of use.
I think that's going to be something that we're going to see a lot of in this edition, is Games Workshop maximizing the functionality of a D6 dice, in my opinion. Because a lot of publications have come out in the past year that have said, why is this game still being played on a D6? And I think this is their answer. Just watch how we manipulate this D6 dice to make it fun and interactive and interesting.
So the bolt gun is also kind of interesting here. It's 24 inches, has rapid fire 1. I guess we can speculate what that rapid fire 1 means. Strength 4, damage 1.
And that's kind of interesting, is you wonder what rapid fire 1 means. And without something to compare it to, and without really understanding how rapid fire weapons are going to work, it makes me wonder how that's going to influence things like charging, how that's going to influence things like how many shots you get at a certain range. Do you remember, was it fourth edition, Paul, where if you shot your pistol, you could shoot it like twice within 12 inches, but you couldn't charge?
If you shoot it once and then charge. Stationary, you could shoot your pistol twice.
Yeah, like there's a couple different, you know, paths that they have walked in that could be, they could be walking those paths again, exploring those rules opportunities one more time.
Is there going to be a rapid fire die? Maybe you roll, it's like a old sustained fire die type deal. I mean,
Fury of the Legion? Yes, please.
You know, who knows? I mean, it's, you know, it's where sustained fire used to have a, you know, 1, 2, 3 and a jam on it. And that was how many hits you did from your sustained fire. You rolled the jam, then your weapon. I'm not saying we're going to see that here. I'm just saying that could signify its own type of die. It could be its own type of roll. Or maybe that just means, you know, if you stand still, then you fire twice. Who knows?
Questions abound.
Yeah. So the last cannon here, 48-inch range, heavy 1. And maybe that's what it, maybe it's the rapid fire 1 means that you can rapid fire, but you don't charge. Whatever. We can infer things we don't know until we see it. Strength 9. AP minus 3, so that means a negative 3 to your save, and then damage is D6.
Insane.
Now here's what surprises me about it. I was expecting to see ranges on weapons decrease a bit, just as a way of compensating for what they've said was going to be a re-emphasis on assault. Not so much that they're trying to make assault better than shooting, right? But just so that, the shorter something range is, the more likely you can get over there.
But I also think, believe it or not, they say that things are going to die quicker in this game. I think there's more survivability to some degree. And my theory is that the points costs for upgrades like a LAS cannon or a grav cannon, again, we don't know. We can theorize what a grav cannon is going to be. We did that all day this morning between the guys on the show in our chat. But we have no idea what the last cannon is going to cost in the new edition. If you look at the way Shadow Wars is set up and the way that the points rubric works, I mean, a last cannon would be a pretty hefty feat in the new edition.
I don't think we're going to see that swing. I think it's supposed to represent the scarcity of a last cannon in that environment. I think we're still going to see it in the comparable to what we'd see it now in point wise in 40K.
Well, what I like about it is it's only affecting the one model that gets hit. So you're not shooting a last cannon, rolling a 6, and being like, "Haha, that's 6 dead guardsmen." No, this is
movie Marines from, you know, 10, 15. I was going to say 10 years ago. Heck, it might have been 15 at this point. That they released a joke list of if the Marines were in an action sci-fi movie, what would their weapons and stats be? So like 10 Marines was 2,000 points, and last cannons did. They beamed across the table and hit everything in their path.
Well, it's like that old Space Marine game. You could shoot through walls with the last cannon and hit the people hiding behind cover. That was.
I agree with you, Chris. Like, I think it's great that that's what, the way the last cannon's going to work. But I also think it does speed up play. It's just kind of like, all right, I'll roll anything but a six. I pick up this model. There's nothing else to fight, worry, or argue over. I think cover will be interesting because cover is going to essentially affect your save from what we gather. Right, Paul?
If I were a betting man, I would say that it would, it's going to improve your save.
Do you think that we're going to have more than one cover save modifier in the game? They did, Chris, they did. You're absolutely right. Like, I knew that there's going to be at least a blanket plus one cover if you have cover, and that's going to be a plus one to whatever save that you have. But I'm curious if there's going to be a ruin cover save or just a plus one cover save in the game.
Has to be. I mean, they were specific to say that every piece of scenery is also going to have rules.
Yeah. I mean, that's very interesting.
Yeah. So I would imagine that we'll see things, you know, like we just saw with the Shadow War stuff, all those pieces of scenery that came out, they gave you a specific cover save, but that's different. I know it's different, but anyway, what I'm saying is there were rules specifically around the cover that they granted. And I think that we'll see that carry through. I would imagine. I mean, I guess to fully answer your question, I would imagine that we would.
Right. Okay.
But where I was going earlier in the last segment, or two segments ago, I guess at this point, is D weapons. Now they're saying that D's not going to be the same. It's not going away, but functionally.
Oh, no. Paul, a game designer tweeted that D does not exist in the new edition.
Okay. Bear with me. Hold out.
Okay.
So if we go with the same line of thinking that a Laz cannon is strength 9, negative 3, and D6 wounds, but yet a D cannon.
Oh, we're going to be talking about a Wraith cannon now?
Something along the lines of a Wraith cannon, or things that would be capable of doing D shooting.
Strength 14.
Right. Like, if it's how many? Like strength 10, minus 9 save, and 2d6 wounds. Yeah.
Yeah, then the effect more or less stays the same, right?
Functionally the same. Although I would imagine, now look, we don't know, but if you save, I mean, I guess what we're assuming is that you save the wound, then no damage is applied. So maybe they'll put it in there to where, you know, invulnerable saves can still block it, but if it gets through, then you're taking the 9,000 wounds or whatever. That's conceivable.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I can see very, very different applications of that coming into play. And how they manage those sorts of things, because from what we know, I mean, that they're trying to get rid of the things that got rid of interaction. One of the things I'm the most curious about is stomps, but D, in a sense, acts like stomps, you know, when you roll the six or whatever. I wonder how they're going to manage those sorts of things. Like, anything
stomp
that
even exists, though? Like, yeah, do we know that stomp
I don't
is
know.
Going to even be there?
We don't know. It's just a matter of, like, how are we going to manage these things that, I suppose, I mean, the role of the stomp really was to get rid of the Death Star, right? But Death Stars aren't going to exist either. So.
I don't even know. Do you think that they developed stomps to get rid of the Death Stars? Do you think that that's why?
I think
that's what stomps ended up doing.
Stomps were right. A good way of saying this creature is a big, bad mamma jamma, and he does stuff on the table.
So. I'm just questioning Chris's comment because it sounded like he was saying that Games Workshop intuitively and purposefully introduced stomp to get rid of Death Stars.
No, that's why stomp in comped play was always left alone. Right. Is that, you know, you look at places like the ITC, you know, several of the different tournament packets I've seen, they'll modify your D, your range D, but stomps and D in melee combat, they stay the same. And the reason for that was they wanted something that could get rid of Death Stars. They being more of a tournament organizer, because GW has come out and said, you know, they didn't even think that Death Stars were going to happen. That was not something that they built into the game intentionally.
My bad. All right. So with the idea that they said that things are going to be keyword driven, and this is where the future of some of our strategy talks is probably going to be around keywords.
Yeah, I think keywords is going to be the new hot topic.
So what they're saying is that Death Stars, where the intent, or I guess the way that went pear-shaped in their mind was bringing units that wouldn't normally be together. And so that will be somehow abated with the keyword system. So that we know. And I don't want to theorize too much because, I don't want to necessarily tell you. Look, I buy on the news. Full disclosure, I bought some Gene Stealer cult figures just because I think they're going to be exciting in the new edition. And I have no reason to base that. I have nothing to base that on. Nothing. I just wanted to buy something. And I got some Gene Stealer cult figures. So I understand. But also,
you've been talking to Justin Troop too much. Mr. Impulse Buy.
I don't want to get too speculative on how things are going to, like, what units are going to be good. But where I was going with the D stuff, though, is that D weapons, they did have a place. They definitely had a place. And there were some, like, a basket of rules. And where, and Chris, you made a good point today in our chat of the fact that you said that there wouldn't be necessarily a reason to have creatures classified as, like, gargantuan creatures or whatever. They would just, you said that there was, that they would just have a basket of stats.
Right.
And I think that that's important, and that's true, but there was also a collection of rules attached to gargantuan creature that may become a keyword. And then when we also got the idea that, so that's when I was thinking that maybe a keyword for gargantuan creatures, and then I thought, well, the rules aren't going to be that many pages, so maybe they're not going to have this whole section just dedicated to them.
Yeah, from what we understand, we're looking at 12 pages of rules, which is three times as many as Age of Sigmar. So, you know, kudos for being the more complicated game, you know, all you guys who are really anxious about that. But what it comes down to is eliminating, you know, redundancies. Or what is the need for a gargantuan monstrous creature if all of its rules are contained in within its own data sheet, and you have weapons that are doing multiple wounds, and you have increased the wounds on even your most generic tanks in order to compensate for.
You hit it on the head too. Is that, you know, I've only got things to, like, big creatures to compare this to in Sigmar. Is that for a Tree Lord, all his rules are all right there on the page. He may have the keyword Tree Lord or whatever. It's not a real thing, but he may have a keyword there. But all his rules are right there on that page. And so what that does is give them flexibility to design things specific to that data slate that they don't necessarily have to attach all this other stuff to it.
Right. I mean, it basically lets you, you know, instead of just saying, well, here's my Wraith Knight. My Wraith Knight is a shooty Wraith Knight, but it still can stomp and do this stuff in close combat. You're going to be able, you know, as a game designer, you're going to be able to specialize, like, no, I want this to be more shooty. I want there to be more of a reason to take this to shoot things with than to swing, you know, to swing your gun cannons around with, or, you know, just pick your nuance, right? And, yep, and pick a purpose for that model.
So,
and
write it down. What we're talking about is developing unit specific rules that don't necessarily rely on universal special rules. Is that correct? Is that the heart of the topic right now?
That's pretty much universal special rules is, you know, of course, what we know is the hit and runs and all that stuff, but the gargantuan creature specifically, and things like monstrous creatures and whatever, all these unit types had their kind of collection basket of rules. Like even bikes.
Right.
Bikes have three or four rules associated with being a bike, and that might not be present in a rule book. It might make its way onto the data slate. And so things like a Space Marine bike, you conceivably have, you know, can't be pinned and some other things, and nor dangerous terrain or something like that, where an orc bike might not have those things.
Well, I think it's great because I can't tell you how many games I've played where people are like, Demon Prince is a monstrous creature. Can it smash?
That something like that will more than likely it'll be all beyond the data slate, I would imagine. Now, look, we don't know, but that's what we can theorize. We were also talking about in the line with like weapons and things like D weapons and high strength and everything having a toughness now, including dreadnoughts. You know, are things like dreadnoughts anyway? Is there still a need to have something like instant death around? And then how do you think that would apply in the world we're going to be living in soon?
So
That's where Justin and I were talking in the chat earlier today. We're talking about, is there really a need for instant death to function like it does now? And I like what Justin had to say about it. I wish he was here. But essentially, you know, in Sigmar, you have something called a mortal wound, and it's something that's unsavable, right? And unless you have, you know, there's an occasional rule here or there that says, well, on like a 5 or a 6 or on a 6, you can ignore a mortal wound. But in the context of 40K, like an instant death weapon, you know, swinging that does, you know, D6 wounds, to roll another D3 for each wound that causes to see if it does another D3 wounds, the way that instant death functions now would be cumbersome and it would not work. It's a little redundant with the idea of rolling a die for multiple wounds per attack.
I'm curious to hear Paul's thoughts and Chris, actually, your opinion, because I don't know if that's your opinion or if that's just a statement.
That's more of an observation on my part. If I were to say this is how I think it's going to be, I would say that instant death isn't going to exist the way that it exists now. You're not going to have a weapon where you swing it at a 12-wound Carnifex, and with one successful wound, it's going to pick up Carnifex. What you're going to do is you're going to have wounds that will inflict automatically, or you're going to have some other game mechanic that makes instant death make sense with the way the rules are changing.
I hope that's kind of what we see, because instant death also had the added ability of ignoring feel no pain. You couldn't take feel no pain rolls against instant death. And so that was a way to getting through some of these tougher units. Now, we can only imagine that some form of feel no pain will probably exist. You know, heck, maybe it won't, and this is a moot point. You know, I don't know. But with instant death having that extra thing, I think moving to something, just calling it, this weapon does mortal wounds, or if you take a wound from this weapon, you take an additional mortal wound or something. You know, I think that, and then having its own, you know, 40K word to it or whatever, may be a little cleaner solution.
I think they're going to try and eliminate as many steps as possible. It's part of streamlining gameplay. Like they're saying that a full, you know, match play match at a, you know, 2000 point level should take 2 hours or less. I mean, the less times you make someone roll a die, the less you have to worry about something like that.
I hope so. And this is, of course, we're talking about the complexities and the strategies and theorizing and all this kind of stuff, but I think it's going to be a much cleaner and faster game. And that means we get to play more, and that the generalship of the actual player is going to come out more and have a bigger determining factor in the victory.
That's what I hope for the most, is based on what I've seen. And we talked about this earlier today, is in my opinion, your ability to control the movement phase and manipulate terrain on the battlefield to your favor is what separates the, so to speak, men from the boys and the women from the girls in this game. Anybody can bring a net list. Anybody can bring the powerful unit and do well with it. But the person that can do those two things really shines in any environment. And I think we're going to see that come through with the new edition.
I hope so. Well, let's get to the finishing move segment. We're going to do the finishing moves a little bit differently today. We're going to maybe do a series on preparing a brand new army. I can see a lot of people wanting to change it up a bit, or maybe alter what their current build is and start to build something totally fresh.
Hold on. Are you trying to say that people might be playing new armies soon?
I think that this is going to be an inspiration for people that just to be enthusiastic enough to try things. And of course, the efficiencies are going to change. So yes, I am definitely saying that.
I was
definitely
happy.
Maybe.
Yeah. I don't know if I'll be necessarily building that, but I say that with also mentioning that I just got some figures on an impulse, and I know for a fact I'll be doing something different. The finishing move segment today is sponsored by Frontline Gaming. Frontline Gaming mats, so they're being manufactured right here in the USA. They've got over 80 different mats to choose from. A lot of that is for different games altogether. It doesn't have to be just for 40K. They have different mat sizes for just about any game that uses miniatures. If you haven't checked them out, please do that. And as I mentioned also, SoCal open registration starts on May 1st.
Yeah, man. I am a full believer of the Frontline, that FLG mats.
Oh, dude, I set up and played my first game inside my new house on Friday of last week with a FLG mat, and it was great. I mean, you just put some boards on top of your kitchen table, roll it out, and throw some terrain on top, and you're ready to go.
This is a full-on sponsor segment now, guys. So we're more than likely going to be getting a little audio clip that we play right here. It's going to be real fancy. It won't just be for our other sponsors and the people that help make this show possible. We're going to, you know, polish this section completely up. I know it's been a long time coming, but you know, I really enjoy doing this one, so I think it's time to, you know, put that shine on it.
You should get that. You should get the commercial I made for Reese and them when I was down in their studio, where they had me do a commercial for them for their FLG mats.
Maybe we will. I don't know what they're going to send me. We'll see. So as I mentioned, what we're going to talk about is actually one of the top layers on a vehicle or on something or whatever. We're going to talk about chipping. Chipping through very specific methods. And the reason we're going to cover the methods that we are now is that it looks very, very difficult. It looks extremely difficult, but it gives you a texture that it cannot be replicated by sponge or even hand painting on chips and stuff. There's several different ways to do this. You're going to get slightly varying effects with it. But the key here is that you're going to get a texture that you cannot accomplish just with some of the techniques we talked about so far.
Well, and to add to that, Paul, it's also fairly simple. And I think, you know, Chris, at the beginning of the show or today, we were talking about what we were going to cover today for finishing moves. And Chris was like, isn't that more of an advanced topic? But it's, and Chris is right. He's right to think that. But I just did this exact process on 6 Venoms in the period of this show. So it's a fairly simple process.
You can look at some stuff like my ad mech. You can follow, there's tutorials. Orc Painter Nerd has an amazing tutorial on YouTube.
Yes,
that,
he does.
That I followed. But his like 4 hours of videos, man. We're going to give you the Reader's Digest here in 10 minutes. because, I mean, it is to get the base effect, it really is this simple. And you can use some products. And some of them are commonly available. Some are available at your grocery store. Some of them you're at your hobby store.
So, Paul, should we
choose your poison?
Before we get into the products that do this, should we introduce at least the science behind it and what we're trying to, like, and how this works?
We only got 10 minutes. We got no time for science.
We can do it.
No time for science.
No, it's okay.
This is a very pro-science show. But essentially, you know, to keep it simple, what we're talking about is a weathering technique that involves removing paint on top to show a color underneath that also gives a physical texture to the model, while also a difference in color that makes it look like natural battle damage.
Like it's been beat to crap. Like you put it in the spin cycle with a handful of rocks and loose change in your dryer.
So we're not getting into atoms or anything here. It's except with Adam.
I wasn't going to get to go that far, but I was going to walk through the steps on how this works. And I won't get into it, but what you're doing is putting down a layer that is a flexible layer of paint between your first layer of paint and the layer on top, right? And that can be, Paul likes to use AK interactive chipping medium, which I've used and it's fantastic. I also use Vallejo makes a chipping medium. And another technique is to use hairspray right out of the can.
That's pretty where I'm talking stuff. About. You can get this, the products we talked about, the AK stuff. Now, this technique is present in a lot of historical miniatures, like tanks and half tracks and buildings and stuff for historical. This is, they use this kind of stuff all the time, and it does have, you know, it's starting to work its way into our hobby realm. But the key is the steps are very important, and the length of time that you let things dry is very important. You really where like the video where Duncan Rhodes says, you know, come back in 10 minutes after you let it dry, and he gives the time lapse. You really gotta wait.
No,
the time.
You want to wait an hour at least.
Yeah, there's gonna be some kind of a montage in between when you apply this and when you take it off.
So when you gotta say, I'm gonna use a rhino as an example. Take a rhino and you want to prime it. You want to put a coat of prime on there like you would anything else. This is all, everything I'm gonna describe is gonna be simple stuff that takes zero talent.
We're following the normal steps. We're just adding two steps in between. That's all it is.
Zero talent, and I'm not kidding. So get your rhino, prime it. Then what I do, and anime have his own variation, but then I take a couple of two or three colors that I like the look of. Now, the kind of the interesting thing is that these colors don't come through exactly. There's not going to be a one-to-one translation of your colors that you're going to see at the end.
It's going to be completely random,
which is kind of interesting. So take almost like sloppy camo that you're going to cover your vehicle in, and you want to get in the crevices. What I do is I use like a really dark brown. Brown color. It could be a dry-eyed bark or a burnt umber or whatever in some of the deepest crevices. And then I kind of put splotchy two-tone gray around there. I've got a dark gray and a lighter gray that I do over the prime. And so it looks like a flaming pile of garbage, something you would never want to put on your table. You never want
to. But you want it to. You want it to look like, that's the goal. Make it look like a flaming pile of garbage.
Yeah.
If it doesn't look like a flaming pile of garbage, you've done it wrong.
And you're not chunking on the paint. These are just, you're just getting a little coverage in the areas. Again, you can get defined almost like you're pre-shading with. Now, this is something you want to do with an airbrush, also. By the way, you do a lot of brush techniques. I'm with you, but it's a little easier with an airbrush. I know.
Yes.
We keep this segment primarily to brush techniques, brush and other handheld stuff that's not the airbrush or the compressor and stuff. But this, I prefer the airbrush. So now that you've got this splotchy mess, here's where you can put your flavor du jour of product on top of this. But I'm sorry, you want to seal it first. I satin varnish.
Yeah, you must seal it. Yeah.
Apologies. I almost skipped a step in the ease. Satin varnish on top of this.
Don't use gloss. You can use matte or satin, but do not use gloss.
So after you put the satin varnish on there, you want it to dry. You want that to be dried completely. You know, no sticky, no tack to the touch at all. You want it to be dry completely.
Now, how long would you say where you are? Because, Paul, you're in a more humid area, right?
Yeah, I'm saying 45 minutes.
You're saying 45 minutes.
I'm in Louisiana. I'm in a more humid area than he is. I like to wait, just to be safe, at least an hour.
Put it down, go to dinner, come back.
Yeah.
That may be the best way to describe it. I live
in a desert and I always feel like waiting it like a full day just to be safe, but maybe I'm overdoing it.
Well, as long as it's not tacky to the touch, and you can touch it, you know, on the bottom or whatever, someplace it's going to be inconspicuous and see, but you want it to be, you know, like a solid, dry finish that's on there.
This is not something you can artificially rush. Like
I guess you could, I mean, with a fan or, you know,
or hair dryer. I mean, hair dryer.
You probably could. I don't suggest it though, because you're dealing with, at some level here, there is probably some chemistry involved.
Oh, so do we want to go back to science
now? No science. Still science free. Just time. Just let the time take, you know, or whatever. It can't be tacky to the touch. So after you've sealed it, and this is on top of your splotchy mess, right? Your Monet or whatever you've done on this tank. Then you want to use one of these products. I have Vallejo and I have AK, and I prefer the AK because I feel like it gives me a more consistent chip when I get to the chipping stage. But everyone's results could be different. They are both great products.
Right.
And they both do what they say they're going to do.
In my findings, they do the exact same thing, but it takes they have different setting properties. So AK sets, in my opinion, sooner, which is relevant to what we just said 3 minutes ago when Paul said 45 minutes, I said an hour. In about an hour, the Vallejo product will set to the same effect that AK will.
So after you spray, now you could also mean at your hobby store, you might only have one product or the other, or at your preferred online dealer, they may only have one product or the other. But this is the step you'd also could use your hairspray.
Yeah, hairspray is the cheap man's go of it. I don't want to say cheap, but it's, you can get a 90-cent bottle of hairspray at the dollar store.
And I think it's got to be a water-based gel or something, right? Doesn't it have to be a specific type? Use this. So
this is where the science really helps, guys.
Exactly. Yeah. This is exactly what the AK Interactives and the Acrylicus Vallejo are. They're a water-based gel that are a little bit diluted so that they'll go through an airbrush.
There you go.
And it's the same. And that's why it works, is that it's a gel that sits between the layers. And you can wipe away the gel. But here's the thing. You need to add water to reactivate the gel because the gel will sit. It's almost like a silicone layer in
between. We're almost there. We're almost to the point where we're talking about that. But that's where, if you're going to use hairspray, make sure it is a water-based gel hairspray. It should say that on the container. I think, it's not going to be a mystery, but you might not want to buy it online because you might not be able to tell it's what you need for that. So then after you've applied this coat of your product, that to me is where, this is why I'm saying it's easy to use. You follow me so far?
Easy to use because all you're doing is applying a layer of the product. That's it.
You're applying a layer
of the product. And time. It's product and time. That's it. It's a two-part ratio.
Sounds good. So now you've got let that dry. So now you put on your coat of whatever your top coat of your paint is. And then if you're using Ultramarines Blue, it's that. If you're using, you know, Lothran Blue, like I was using for the AdMech, that's what it is. Then you simply coat the vehicle for your top coat. Easy, right?
Well, hold on. I mean, it can be more than just your top coat, especially if we're working with the airbrush. It's because you can't, that's the one thing. You cannot dry brush over this or else you'll wipe all of your work away. But if you're working with an airbrush, you can do your base coat, your mid-tone, and your highlight over top of this medium, whether it's hairspray, AK, or Vallejo, and then jump into what Paul's about to start talking about.
Well, this is where, I mean, you can take it from here, because I use a toothbrush now at this point. After that dries completely, then I get a little bit of bowl of water and a toothbrush, put the toothbrush in the water, and you just kind of like start to work away, almost like you're not scrubbing, like you're trying to really get rid of something, but you can kind of almost, you know, make little circles or rub across certain areas of the tank, and that water activates the gel, starts to loosen the top coat of paint, and so then you're starting to get this variation and see these chips appear.
So first of all, don't use the toothbrush that you're going to brush your teeth with. Let's just get that one.
That's a very good point. I fully endorse that point right there.
I like to use, there's four tools that I like to use, and you don't need to use all four of them. They all produce similar results, but It depends on the size of the vehicle, in my opinion. But the toothbrush, like Paul was saying, toothpicks, have them handy. You can make some really great and very realistic scratches with them. If you have an old dry brush, or if you want to take a brush that's just old and dwindled away before you throw it in the trash, cut it down with a pair of scissors so you've got some rough bristles. That works very well. And a Q-tip. Because once you put the water on top and you get your effect going, you want to stop the chemical reaction that's happening, that's reactivating the gel underneath. So you want to wipe away as much water as you can. But you can also use a Q-tip to apply water. Dip the Q-tip in water and put it on top of the model before you get after it with your brush, your toothbrush, or your toothpick.
And what you're going to see the difference in the layers. Like it's still just layers of paint, right? But you are going to see this texture that we're talking about start to appear, because you're going to have these gouges, these what looks like aeons of wear on a vehicle.
Yeah,
I like to think of how I saw Mr. Justin do it when he was doing his weathering class with us down here in Salt Lake. Where he just took the toothbrush and it was a tank chassis he was using as an example, and he just started wailing on it like it was a spider that needed to death by toothbrush. He just started wailing on it, and you could see because he picked a different section of the tank for each tool that he was using, kind of like what Adam was talking about, using a toothpick to create some scratches. And what it really did is it did that thing that your lady friend always hates about the kitchen counter. It's like, oh, this is, you know, the edge here or the paint is peeling off of like the floorboards or whatever. And you can see the 10 layers that the previous owners of the house used. Like it is that effect that you're getting on your miniatures. And it's not just something that you're looking at and you has a visual texture. It has a texture as you touch too. It makes it look really authentic.
Yeah, and I think what it really comes down to, and going back to what Paul was saying earlier, is what you apply as your base coat before you seal and before you apply this medium. And you have to give some thought to this. And it's we've talked about color balance on the show. We've talked about color theory. I really like to use metallics underneath, and I like to use metallics with a plain, like if I'm using a dark color, you know, for example, I'm doing a dark Eldar army for Michael, who's in Georgia, listener of the show. You know, I base coated with Vallejo primer gray and just threw some copper over top of that in random areas. And that's the thing. You don't want to put too much thought into where you're putting this copper down, because you want it to be randomized.
You do. So you want like a reveal at the end.
Exactly.
It's going to have a much more organic pattern, like it was sitting somewhere for 500 years or something.
Exactly. And you start pulling it away and you're going to say, oh, I see copper in this instance. And then as you pull it away more, you see some of that gray white color. And it's like, holy crap, this looks really good. Like this looks like real weathering. This looks like this has been through the warp and back, and paint was peeled off as it was re-entering the atmosphere of whatever planet they were resurfacing. And it's a really cool effect. And if you do it right, I mean, this is a time-saving effort here, because this sounds like it's a lot of time, but it's really not if you're doing a whole army at once.
Well, and also, if you're just doing one vehicle, you're doing a minute or two of work, leaving and coming back. A minute or two of work, leaving and coming back.
Right. I'm doing 6 Venoms right now, and the edge highlighting that I'm going to have to do is going to be very minimal. You almost don't have to, because you've added that extra textural level to it. And if you get around the edges with that toothpick, and this is why I recommend toothpick, dip it in water and just rub it on the hard edges of that model, and you pull away that paint and you've almost edge highlighted that model by itself. And you're not edge highlighting it in a way that, you know, and what Games Workshop does is fantastic, but the way that Games Workshop does, you're edge highlighting it in a way that historical miniatures, as Paul was saying, are traditionally done. It's a more realistic effect. You're bringing the undertones of the model back out, and you're saving yourself some time. So you get a whole army done this way. I mean, you could do Space Marines this way if you wanted to. Throw a wash on top when you're done, and you know, paint some shoulder pads and the bolt gun and some eyes, and you've got a maxed out point rubric army for the next tournament that you're going to.
Yeah, this is kind of like, and I use it to differentiate armies. Like I like some armies to be fresh off the assembly line, you know, but I like some armies.
Yeah, my Blood Angels are always nice and shiny and clean.
They spend a lot of time. Yeah, cleaning those vehicles.
Yep.
But this is something that weathering is a deep rabbit hole. So
yeah.
you can now take what we just learned right now and go real far with it. Like you can then start to pin wash the recesses with gritty texture with oil bases or acrylic bases. I mean, or acrylic based products. I mean, but there's a lot of products out there that do a lot of the work for you. And this is one of the chipping fluids that we described. That's where like almost all the magic occurs.
So I'm just going to take the segment one step further. I know that we're running out of time, Paul, but I have to do it now that we're on the topic. But think about a chapter. Let's just imagine a chapter that had changed colors. They had changed their chapter allegiance or whatever it may have been. Let's think of Paul, perfect example, the Luna Wolves, right? They were white before they went to that seafoam green.
That is true. And Death Guard also changed colors several times.
They were. All right. So let's use Death Guard because they're going to be the new, I think we all know that they're going to be in the next box set. I think that's going to happen. We know that they're coming, but
seems reasonable.
So what were they called, Chris, before they were the Dusk Raiders?
For which ones?
Death Guard.
The Death Guard, yeah, Dusk Raiders. They had a red, sort of a half-red shoulder pad kind of look to them. Look, real nice-looking scheme.
Red and gray.
It was like, I think it was one arm was like a dark red and gray. And just imagine a Dusk Raider or Rhino for a second, because that's an easy example. And if it was dark gray on one half and then red on the other, and that was your base, and then on top of that, before you weather that, like put metallics under that, because that Rhino is metallic before you put those grays and the reds on top, weather that, and then put the chipping medium back on top after you seal the gray and the red in, and then throw your bone and green on top, whatever it might be, throw your chipping medium again on top and weather that, and you're going to have, in my opinion, the most fluffy army in the existence of 40K.
That's an interesting idea. I'll give it to you, man. But I don't want to gloss over. I just did a Chris Morgan thing right there. Your point you just made, because I want to finish this up with, you have to seal this when you're done.
Yes.
When you get to the level, I even suggest sealing it after you've done your chipping, before you do any additional weathering, before you do any additional highlighting or other details, seal it to lock in the work you've done.
Paul's absolutely correct, because the chipping gel, I think is what we're going to call it now, that medium that you're using is very fragile, and any application of moisture to it will manipulate its texture on the model itself. So, you know, you go back in and do your edge highlight and you get a little heavy with it, it will start moving paint away. You don't want that to happen. So seal it with a matte coat or a gloss coat, whatever you prefer. I recommend a matte coat or satin coat. Paul, I think you would recommend the same.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, whatever your finish is going to be that you're with the rest of your army, I prefer at this stage, until I know I'm going to put my final seal on there, I prefer a satin, because I think the paint flows, this is to me anyway, I think the paint flows a little bit better on a satin.
It does. A satin's like a 70-30 version of gloss to matte. So there's a little bit of gloss in there that it allows the surface tension to allow the paint on the brush to flow a little bit smoother. So you're absolutely 100% correct.
Guys, it's been a great show. We're going to wrap this up. I really appreciate y'all gushing with me over 8th edition. That's going to be a consistent theme. I'm not going to make any apologies about it. It's going to be...
You got at least 2 weeks of it, right?
A lot of talk about 8th edition coming up, and then hopefully playing 8th edition pretty soon. And then, you know, more to come, guys.
I just wait till we get those army books in our hands, guys.
Good night, everybody.
See ya.
Thanks for listening.